Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Alexandra Nicholas about her book, Phoebe Apperson Hearst, A Life of Power and Politics. Alexandra, welcome to New Books Network.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Ooh, something about myself. Okay, well, this project has taken up most of my adult life. I started this project as my dissertation many years ago at the University of California at Davis, and then I turned it into a book. And by the time I got finished, it's taken me about 35 years to complete. So it's been a commanding aspect of my life for quite a while. And when I first started this project, I thought, oh, my goodness, do I really want to spend a lot of time on devoting my effort to somebody who had a lot of money. And as it turns out, this project has been very interesting. After all these years, I've yet to be bored by Phoebe Apperson Hearst.
Well, it definitely comes across in your book. She led such a fascinating life.
She did. She had her fingers in many, many different pots and activities.
What drew you to her in the first place?
Actually, it was practical considerations. I was working full-time, teaching five classes, and I didn't have a lot of money. And so I needed a research project that I could do close by that didn't require extensive travel somewhere else. And a colleague of mine suggested that I look at the George and Phoebe Hearst papers at the University of California Bancroft Library.
You did research in these papers, and as you said, you wrote a dissertation and you went on to write this book. And yet it's more than just a straightforward account of her life and her times. As you explain, Phoebe Apperson Hearst has something to tell us about women in 19th, early 20th century America that we sometimes overlook.
Yes, very true. I think probably the most important general permanent legacy that she has to offer us is to teach us about how she acquired and controlled and used money and her other resources to bring her power. Power isn't money in it itself, which is often a cliche, money is power, but it's something that you need to have the ability to achieve. And for Phoebe Apperson Hearst, in her case, she was very intelligent, and she used her own personal informal interpersonal skills, among other skills that she had, to really advance herself or a career for herself. And that path that she took eventually brought her power in a number of different ways.
That was one of the things I found really fascinating when I read the book, because when we think of power in the realms where she exercised it, it's typically the realm of men. It's politics, it's policy, it's public life, and that was reflected in her husband, who was a United States senator. That was reflected much more famously with her son, who went on to become a congressman, a newspaper publisher of great renown and fame or infamy, depending upon your point of view. and so their story and their power is well known. And yet, as you explain, she was just as influential, even without having to, even without serving an elective office, even without, as you explain, you know, having the power to vote for most of her life.
Yes, I think most people have heard of the Hearst, and as you pointed out here, William Randolph Hearst has received a lot more attention. Some people are familiar with the Phoebe Hearst name, but they really don't know much about her. So this book really does lay out many of the important aspects of her life. And she was unusual in a number of different ways. Most people think that the only kind of power that women, particular in this time period, could acquire was by voting. And people think about the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which granted women the constitutional right to vote. But there were millions of women involved in just thousands of voluntary associations in the United States, and they had the right to vote. And there were other instances across the nation where women had the right to vote. For example, in California, in 1874, there was a law that actually said that women could hold public educational offices. And so here in San Francisco, for example, they actually ran in school board elections, even though women couldn't vote in those elections at the time. So it's sort of fascinating to see the different political aspects in which Phoebe Hearst was involved.
Another part of the her life that's so fascinating is the journey that brought her to that point. Because as you explained, she was not a person born of wealth, born of status, but she was a person who, you know, grew up in some pretty challenging circumstances.
Yes. Practically all women during this period had to contend with and grapple with constraints of sex and class that were placed upon them. So anyone who was ambitious, like Phoebe Hearst, and there were a number of ambitious women in the 19th and early 20th century, they had to figure out ways to navigate the corridors of power, ways to, within the constraints of sex and class, acquire power, which was a challenge for many women. And in Phoebe's case, she had virtually no role models to follow. When she came out to San Francisco in 1862, shortly after she married George Hearst, and she was 22 years younger than George Hearst, which many people don't know, she was in a situation where she didn't know anybody, where only approximately 30% of San Francisco population was female at the time. And after William Randolph Hearst was born, George got up and left to go off and engage himself in his pursuits and personal interests. He loved the world of mining. And that left Phoebe Hearst alone, pretty much, with the exception of a governess that was there to help her raise Willie. And she was very lonely, dissatisfied in her marriage, unhappy. And so she had to try and figure out what she was going to do to turn herself into a self-made woman, which is how her parents raised her, to be very ambitious and eventually self-supporting and get involved in useful work. So that meant that she had to develop abilities, skills, really to bring herself down the road to acquiring the necessary resources in order to bring herself power. So she had virtually no one to talk to about this, and there were very few role models at the time. She didn't have any contact with those that existed across the country. So it was a challenging endeavor for her, as well as other women who became powerful during this period.
As you explained, she gains, you know, she enters this life of wealth through her marriage to George. And yet, as you explain as well, that, you know, that wealth was not necessarily stable as well. So she has that, I was struck by, on the one hand, you know, she's living in the most opulent hotel in San Francisco. She, as you point out, she has a governess that she can call upon. And yet at the same time, it was not necessarily stable and secure that for her to just assume that wealth was always going to be there.
Yes, that's an interesting point, because Phoebe Hearst, like George Hearst, actually, they both had dreams about coming to California. In George's case, he had dreams about coming to California and making a fortune, which he came out to California originally in 1850. But Phoebe had her dreams as well about California. Early in life, she had dreams about going to California, living in a house with her husband and hopefully six kids. She wanted six children, and she wanted a stable family unit. And then once that happened, she wanted to get involved in California life, to be active in California life. But as soon as George and Phoebe arrived in San Francisco in 1862, the fall of 1862, George shattered that dream of Phoebe almost immediately when he said they were going to live in the Lick Hotel. And the Lick Hotel was the most luxurious hotel in San Francisco at the time, but Phoebe Hearst did not like it. It was too pretentious for her. So George wanted to make her happy, so they moved to a smaller, family-oriented, quieter hotel, the Stevenson Hotel. And that is where William Randolph Hearst was born, the Hearst one and only child, in April of 1863. So in that environment in San Francisco at the time, as you point out, it was really a topsy-turvy place, very unstable. And Phoebe didn't, as I mentioned, know anybody. So it was an anxiety-producing situation for her, actually, initially.
And yet she seemed to rise to the challenge. And I was thinking about not just in terms of the life that you described that she lives early on in her marriage, where she's, you know, in effect running the household while her husband is gone. But you also describe how, as they go on in the marriage, how the travel she undertakes, and something that nowadays we think about as no big deal, that, you know, you simply book a ticket, get on a plane. But she's undertaking these journeys of many months. She's doing it without her husband. I was just fascinated about what that must say about her.
Oh, yes. I think, after William Randolph Hearst was born, George Hearst, as I mentioned, got up and left, which left Phoebe by herself. And she's really lonely, and she really misses George. So early on, she decides, well, since George is not going to come to her, she will go to him. And that really starts her on her travel adventures. Once she travels to visit George, she's very glad to see him, and she really doesn't want to leave him, but she has to go back home because he's involved with his mining and business pursuits, and then eventually political pursuits and interests. But then in 1872, George suggests that Phoebe and Willie go off to Europe, and he meet them over there to attend the Vienna International Exposition. And this is really going to be the first major trip that Phoebe Apperson Hearst takes to Europe, and this is going to be a transforming experience for her. Throughout her life, she goes to Europe many times, and each time she learns something new. And these trips, beginning in 1873, allow her to transform herself into a woman who can fulfill the duties and responsibilities that Americans expected of women married to wealthy men. And it also gives her an opportunity to develop a separate and independent identity from George. So since George is gone a lot of the time, Phoebe has a bit of freedom that most married women don't have. When she gets to Europe in this first trip in 1873, she is allowed, as a result of this experience, to begin to learn how to handle money outside of household finances. She acquires new knowledge about different people and races and cultures in the various countries that she visits. She comes face to face for the first time in her life with real poverty in Ireland. And that starts her thinking about money and what she can do with George's money. Early on in their marriage, George Hearst hands over to Phoebe control of a large part of his fortune because he knows his wife is unhappy because she's lonely and disillusioned with their marriage because he is not around. So these European journeys and adventures are really transforming experiences for her and very important to her. She absolutely loved travel. It was a deeply interesting experience to her and really important in shaping her as an individual and human being.
How are those experiences reflected in her activism when she goes back to California? Do they determine what she focuses on in terms of specific movements? Does she bring in ideas that simply were not there in California before she introduced them? In what way does it define the activism in her home community?
Yes, in both instances. At the time that she begins her travels to Europe, it's beginning to be expected that women married to wealthy men in San Francisco and elsewhere as well should get involved in voluntary associations and their politics. In other words, if you're going to fulfill the duties and obligations of a woman married to a wealthy man, Americans expected wealthy women to get involved in these organizations. So, what Phoebe Hearst does really on these trips is these trips to Europe allow her to gather the knowledge and ideas and experiences that will help her understand the kinds of decisions, the strategic and systematic decisions that she's going to make throughout her life to really help her advance her career. And one of the first important examples of this is in her trips to Europe in the late 1870s and the early 1880s, she begins to learn about the kindergarten movement. And Froebel, who is one of the leaders, the fathers of the kindergarten movement in Germany, and she is actually introduced and meets some of the major reformers in Europe in this movement, and she brings that knowledge and information and ideas that she learned on that trip to Europe as she met these educators, and she brings those back to California and takes the initiative to contact in San Francisco women who are involved in the Golden Gate Kindergarten Association. And one of the most important friendships that she develops in her early life in voluntary association politics is with Sarah B. Cooper, who was the head of the Golden Gate Kindergarten Association in San Francisco. And that's really the first public involvement in voluntary associations that Phoebe gets involved in. She begins to donate money to that group, and that money is used to establish free kindergarten classes for the children of working class, poor and immigrant parents in San Francisco, as well as to train women in the professional occupation of becoming kindergarten teachers. There weren't many occupations open to women and in the professions, and this was one of them. They were allowed to become kindergarten teachers. So her adventures and travels in Europe are really very important in shaping her as an individual and helping her develop, really focusing her attention on her personal interests, and those interests really lead her into the world of volunteer association politics.
And yet, as you explained, this is still a period of her life where she has to subordinate some of her interest and activism to her husband's career. Because you describe how, at this point, her husband, George Hearst, is getting into politics as well. How mm-hmm. does that affect her life? And how does that shape her involvement and her experiences with power?
For women who were trying to get power in the 19th century and beyond, this was really a challenge. And in Phoebe Hearst's case, and I think this may be true of others as well, it was a constant balancing act. She had to satisfy her husband's needs and fulfill the traditional domestic duties as a faithful, dutiful wife on the one hand. But on the other, she also wanted to satisfy herself, make herself happy, pursue her own personal concerns and interests. So in the decisions she made in her life as to what she would do and when and how, she constantly shifted back and forth to meet George's needs while he was home, which wasn't very often. He would come back to visit his family every once in a while, but most of the time he was gone, at the same time that she met her own needs. But George was always ever present in her life, establishing, as I mentioned earlier, limits and constraints on her. And for example, on one trip to Europe, Phoebe was called back early from her trip by George because he was lonely and wanted her to come back. So she did. But later on in her life, and another trip to Europe, Phoebe was older, a little bit more mature. She had more time away from George, and she had developed herself into a more independent person. So she used one of her assistants, Mary Kincaid, as a go-between to convince George to let her stay longer in Europe when he asked to have her come back. And because Kincaid was more skilled at the time in Phoebe's life, had more education, Kincaid was key in convincing George to allow Phoebe to stay longer in Europe. And on this particular trip in the 1880s, that gave Phoebe more time really to gather the information and knowledge she needed to turn herself into a professional philanthropist, which really became her career.
And yet when her husband was elected by the California legislature to the United States Senate, does she continue to do that, or does she accompany him to Washington?
She does indeed accompany him to Washington. He was appointed United States Senator from California in 1886 and then took his position the next year. But this, you know, Phoebe Hearst throughout her whole life tried to take advantage of as many opportunities that were presented to her. She was not one to allow opportunities to pass her by. So this is an early example of that. When they moved to Washington, D.C., they move into a home on New Hampshire Avenue Northwest in D.C. And by this point, Phoebe Hearst had begun to realize that she had an emerging interest in design and architecture that she inherited basically from her father. And that was piqued further later on in her life by attending the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. But by the time she gets to Washington, D.C., she decides that she needs to find a project that would help her advance her husband's political career in Washington, D.C., also help the Hearst as a family gain acceptance into social, political, and intellectual elite circles, but in addition, allow her to pursue her own interests, make herself happy. And she finally hits upon a project that could do that for her, and that is to remodel and renovate this house that the Hearst moved into in New Hampshire Avenue Northwest. And so she gets involved in this project by commissioning architect Harvey L. Page to do the remodel. This is in 1889. And once this project is completed, it's a project really that allows Phoebe Hearst to accomplish the goals and aims that she had. The press reported on this renovated project, and it was seen as a successful project. Then Phoebe Hearst, as a result of the remodel, began to hold social entertainments that would help advance her husband's political career and put the Hearst name out there and help them gain acceptance into elite circles in the nation's capital. And the social entertainments were hailed as great successes. All the while, Phoebe Hearst is balancing her duties as a faithful wife to her husband and helping him advance his career through these social entertainments at the same time that she is satisfying herself by pursuing projects in design and architecture. So she becomes very successful at what she was doing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And yet that period of her life comes to an abrupt end when her husband dies in 1891. And you go into some details to explaining what happens to her at that point, because it really is a pivotal point in her life. Her husband is dead, and it could have gone in a variety of different ways. What is her status when George Hirst dies, and in what ways does that change her circumstances and allow her to redirect herself towards different goals?
Okay. First of all, I mean, virtually nobody, including Phoebe Hearst, was expecting George to pass away in late February of 1891. This really took Phoebe Hearst off guard. She was normally a very confident and optimistic woman, and this shook her confidence. She really didn't know what to do. By this point, however, Phoebe Hearst's activities in the nation's capital had developed a good reputation for the Hearst, including Phoebe Hearst as a social entertainer and Mrs. Senator Hearst, as they called her, a very distinguished, powerful woman. That was her image by the time George Hearst passed away. And once George Hearst passed away, in his will, he left control of his entire estate to Phoebe Apperson Hearst. He did not leave one cent to his son, William Randolph Hearst. And part of the reason for that is William Randolph Hearst was a spendthrift. He, throughout his life, did not handle money very well. But Phoebe Hearst did. George Hearst trusted his wife's ability to manage and control his money. And she had demonstrated that on numerous trips to Europe. So once Phoebe Hearst was given control of the Hearst estate, she knew virtually nothing about how to handle this estate. It was very large, lots of properties, intricate business dealings and contracts. So she's going to be tested very quickly, and she's going to have to learn very quickly about how to supervise and control this estate. So one of the first things that she does is she leaves Washington, D.C. to sort of go back to her rural roots. She goes to Sonoma, California, and sets up Camp Sesame. She erects a tent and lives in this tent for a while, trying to figure out how she's going to adjust to being a 48-year-old widow with control of this entire estate. And she learns pretty quickly. In a couple of years, she's fortunate in that she has inherited business managers that George had and also attorneys. So at first, she relies on these men to help guide her, but it doesn't take her very long to begin to figure out how she can leverage her wealth and other resources, her intellect, her time, her energy, her effort, to really bring her self-power and to advance her philanthropic career.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon that a little bit. What does she start to do with this newfound independence in terms of her philanthropy? What causes does she focus on, and to what degree does she have more freedom of action, and how does she exercise it?
She's always constrained by the limits placed upon women in terms of sex and class. But obviously, since she is a widow, widows traditionally in the 19th century were given more freedom, for obvious reasons. One of the first things Phoebe Hearst does, the first step she takes down her philanthropic path and trying to adjust to being a widow, she begins to learn from her attorneys about what kinds of power and control she has over the Hearst estate. And then understanding the freedom she has in terms of her supervision of the estate, the first small steps that she takes are she begins to gift money to women friends and the daughters of women friends to allow them to realize their ambitions, their dreams. And then after she does that for a while, she starts to think about her personal interests. Now, Phoebe Hearst was an individual who did love children. As I mentioned previously, her dream was to have six children, but since George wasn't around very much, that was hard to do. But she's interested in children, and has a passion for education. So, as I briefly mentioned before, the first really public philanthropic project she gets involved in are the Golden Gate Kindergarten Association. But after she makes a name for herself there, I mean, her name is put out and public in the press in San Francisco in the Bay Area and in California because of her involvement with this issue. She then gets involved in trying to advance women in the medical field in San Francisco. She becomes the president of the Pacific Homeopathic Dispensary or Hospital in San Francisco. And this is an opportunity for her to begin to develop her skills and becoming a powerful philanthropist. She leverages her money and other resources to really force men at the Hahnemann Medical College in San Francisco to accept and work with female physicians at the homeopathic dispensary or hospital in San Francisco. The male grads at the Hahnemann College, once they graduated, they went to the Pacific dispensary to get advanced medical training and experience. So as president of the hospital, Hearst essentially put pressure on these male physicians to accept working with these female physicians at the dispensary because she told them if they didn't, essentially, that she would withdraw her financial support to the Pacific Homeopathic Dispensary. And if she did that, the dispensary would have to close because it was her money that kept it operating and staffed.
I was especially struck by your description of her involvement with the University of California, especially when she becomes a regent, because you had that great scene in your book where she assumes the position and you describe how she is now entering a realm in which it is, you know, it's a very different realm because she doesn't have quite that same degree of leverage. And it's an organization that is dominated by men. She's the only woman on the board. And yet you describe how she does so much for the university at really a pivotal point in its history.
Yes, I probably would say that this is in terms of her philanthropic gifts and her involvement in academic politics. This is arguably her most important legacy, what she does for the University of California at Berkeley. She gets started, actually in 1885 is the first time she gives any amount of money to the university. It's a small amount. She donates money to build a lab for the mining department. But about 6 months after George Hearst passes away, Her first donation, that's a larger gift, to the University of California to help and support women, attract women to come to the university, is when in September of 1891, she donates money to the university to establish five $300 scholarships for women in perpetuity at the university. These come to be known as the Phoebe Apperson Hearst Scholarships. They are still available at the university. So any women out there who are considering going to the university, do check them out. And then as early as 1894, Phoebe Hearst clearly developed in her own mind a comprehensive architectural plan that she decides to offer to the university. And the very first person she talks to about this comprehensive architectural plan is Millicent Shin. And Millicent Shin is an 1880 University of California graduate. She's the first woman to receive a doctorate at the university, and she becomes an author and an editor. And so Phoebe Apperson Hirst talks to Shin about her idea of presenting a comprehensive architectural plan to the university. And the plan really consisted of three parts. The first part was a building, the George Hirst Memorial Mining Building, that she wanted designed and constructed at the university to honor the memory of her deceased husband. The second building was later called Hirst Hall. And at the time that Phoebe Hirst came forth with this idea to build Hirst Hall, she made a strategic decision not to announce publicly the role and function that she had in mind for this building. But down the road, she really wanted this building to be a building for women, a home away from home for women, a place where they could meet each other, develop their networks, and really challenge the power of men on campus. Most women at UC were in a hostile environment. Most men did not want them there. And the only place that they could meet on campus at the time, before Hirst Hall was going to be built and constructed, was in a corner of North Hall. They could eat their lunch. They were allowed to gather there. That was the only place on campus. But then the third part of her architectural plan was to support and hold an international architectural competition to have architects from all over the world, but particularly Western Europe, submit designs for an ideal city of learning, an ideal university. And so once she talked to Millicent Shin about her plan, then it took a while for the university regents to discuss and eventually accept and approve it. But this plan, which Phoebe Hirst was given the formal legal and political power to supervise from start to finish, the regents handed over to her that kind of power, really was going to place the University of California on the map. It brought Phoebe Hirst not only her position as the first female regent at the University of California, Berkeley, but also really provided a worldwide reputation for Regent Hirst and the University of California, Berkeley. And it had a tremendous impact once it was completed on women at the university. It brought great benefits to female students who were inspired by Hirst Hall. And Hirst Hall at the time also included a women's gym. And so as a result of this gym being included in the construction, the design and construction, women students on campus organized a petition to get the regents to hire the first female faculty member with an academic title and a salary as a female medical examiner to examine female students so they could use the gym. And her name was Dr. Mary B. Ritter, who was hired as a female medical examiner by the UC Board of Regents, but she was also hired as a lecturer in hygiene in the Department of Physical Culture. So as a result of Regent Hirst's activities and her support, female students were able to get the first female faculty member with an academic title and a salary, albeit part-time and paid by Hirst. So Hirst's comprehensive architectural plan really had an astounding impact on the university at large, and particularly women students.
And it's really saying something that you regard that as her most lasting legacy, because you describe that at this point in her life, she really has come into her own as this force for philanthropy and civic activism, not just in terms of what she's doing at the University of California, Berkeley, but also with her role with the Panama Pacific International Exposition, which is really a much larger forum, one in which she's interacting with some of the leading public figures of her time.
Yes. After Phoebe Hirst's architectural plan is completed, she eventually goes off to Europe And she has an apartment in Paris. She loved Paris in France, and she stays there for a while. And then she comes back to the United States. She's called back to the United States because of family affairs, business affairs. She really does, by this point, become a competent businesswoman among her many other activities and roles. And she's also called back to the United States because William Randolph Hearst, her son, is struggling once again with financial problems. he's always asking his mother for money. And he eventually gets what he wants most of the time, but not always. So she returns to the United States. And Phoebe Hearst, as one of her friends says, is really almost addicted to volunteer association activities in politics. She loves being active and involved in meaningful, purposeful activities that throughout her life, this brings her meaning in her life and purpose. So she comes back to the United States. And she realizes, because of her extended stay abroad, she has to resurrect her philanthropic career. She has to reinvigorate her career. She's got to remind people about her previous career activities and what she has accomplished in her life. So she finally, after being reluctant in a number of years, comes out in 1911, just before the special election in California, granting women the right to vote. She announces publicly she will support suffrage in California. And then in that same year, she begins to really develop a systematic plan to get people to think about her and campaign for becoming the head of the Women's Board of the Panama Pacific International Exposition. And the way that she does that is by using social events at her Hacienda del Pozo de Verona, which is her first large mansion that she has designed and constructed in her life in the mid to late 1890s. And at the Hacienda, she puts on these fabulous social events. They're very extravagant by this point in her life. She entertains up to 10,000 people leading up to the Panama Pacific International Exposition, of which approximately 4,000 of them are involved in the exposition. So she's really making an effort to let people know that she wants to be active in the exposition and even beyond that, to hold some kind of official position. And she's successful in this effort. She is appointed to the corporation that women who are involved in the exposition form. It's a business corporation. She's brought in as a stockholder, and she is eventually elected as the head of the Women's Board of the exposition. And while she's the head of the Women's Board, her official title initially was as the honorary president. But Phoebe Hearst, from almost the start, needed to turn that honorary position into something that was more meaningful in her life. So the way in which she does that is to take a path through involvement with the National Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA. And she decides to hold a conference in May of 1912. For the YWCA, which is really an effort on the Y's part to make it known to Hearst that they wanted her to represent their national political interests at the Panama Pacific International Exposition. They wanted her to advance their political agenda. And this conference at the Hacienda is very successful. And Hearst goes on to be appointed to the National Board, Executive Committee of the National YWCA Board, as a result of this conference. And she uses then the Y at the Panama Pacific International Exposition to establish the Travelers Aid Society in California. And working with the Travelers Aid Society, which is a mixed volunteer association, it has men as well as women in it, she is able to advance the political agenda, which was a moderate progressive reform agenda at the time of the YWCA. And in the process of all of that, she, using her resources again to leverage power in the exposition, she is instrumental in getting the YWCA building built at the Panama Pacific International Exposition. This exposition does not have a women's building, which other expositions in history had. The YWCA building really worked in that function, not only for women, but also for men. It held a lot of different activities that both women and men attended at the exposition.
You've already alluded to what she is involved with simultaneously, which is the suffrage movement. And I thought that your description of her role in it was a very interesting one, because it gets to, you know, it really is the point at which, you know, her influence is the greatest, and she could use it in a variety of different ways. And the choices she makes are really very interesting ones. They seem to be the ones that really kind of expose what, you know, where she really is in terms of how she thinks power should be exercised, the ways in which to achieve goals for women. What role does she play in the suffrage movement, both within California and nationally?
Yes, Phoebe Hearst was raised by her parents, who were members of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, which was a radical reform wing of the Presbyterian Church. So she was interested in reform causes, and suffrage is going to be one of them. But she's also raised by her parents to be a dignified, respectable woman, always to conduct herself, behave herself as a lady, which she does throughout her entire life. So her first involvement with the suffrage movement actually goes back to 1896 in the California Suffrage Campaign, when she offers the largest cash donation to the campaign in California in that year. But she doesn't get involved in any of its activities. She just offers money. And then, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, she finally announces publicly in the 1911 California campaign that she backs suffrage. But she makes it quite clear that she does not support militant or radical suffragists, because their aggressive, confrontational methods, techniques, really make Phoebe Hearst uncomfortable. So she winds up really backing suffrage as a tool of reform rather than any kind of expression of radical politics. She winds up being a member of the moderate suffrage camp by the early 20th century. And she never does march in Alice Paul's suffrage parades. Alice Paul was the instigator of establishing the Congressional Union, which was a organization that had one political goal only, and that was to get a federal amendment to the Constitution for women to be given the right to vote. So Phoebe Hearst never marches in an Alice Paul suffrage parade, but as a moderate in the suffrage camp, she does wind up marching in a Preparedness Day parade in San Francisco in the summer of 1916. And a Preparedness Day parade backed Woodrow Wilson's position on preparing the United States for possible interest into involvement in World War I, but also to back national defense initiatives that Wilson was supporting. So Phoebe Hearst marches in this parade. Threats to her life and the life of others in this parade were made before the parade, but that didn't stop Phoebe Hearst from marching. And one of the reasons she marched was to prove to many Americans, some of whom criticized women for marching in these kinds of parades, but was to prove to Americans that women were fit for citizenship rights, to have full citizenship rights, the same kind of rights that men had. And once again, she was quite successful in that effort. She marched from beginning to end in the parade without any physical assistance, riding in a car or leaning on anybody's arm or what have you. So she was instrumental, along with other women, in proving to Americans that women were fit for citizenship. But she, by this point, had also become a great symbol to women and others in the United States as a representative of motherhood, of nationhood, of women's activism and reform efforts. So she was quite well known by this point.
It's a shame that she passes away when she does, so close to the ratification of the 19th Amendment.
Yes, she did see, she was alive for the House vote that passed on the 19th Amendment, but she passed away on April 13th of 1919, just before the Senate vote, so she didn't quite see the completion of the vote or the ratification of the 19th Amendment. She passed away from the flu epidemic that turned into pneumonia, and, you know, by this point, she was quite famous, quite prominent. She had some of the most powerful men in California as her honorary pallbearers for her funeral. Condolences just poured in from all over the world, as well as the United States. You know, her legacy, I mean, many of the projects that she got involved in throughout her life are still up and running. The Golden Gate Kindergarten Association, which is now called the Phoebe A. Hearst Pre-Learning Center, is still operating in San Francisco. It's certainly the University of California is still operating, and women are still reaping the benefits from her philanthropy and activism there. The YWCA has an office located right across the street from the University of California at Berkeley. She was also the co-founder of the National Congress of Mothers, which is now called the Parents and Teacher Association, the PTA. So Phoebe Hearst still lives.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I am involved in a project to discover the meaning of the phrase sexual equality from women's point of view, beginning in the period of the American Revolution up to 1920. I'd like to find out what women really meant by that.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project. How far along are you?
I'm beginning to write the first chapter, actually.
Well, congratulations.
Most of the research done, and I hope this summer to begin writing.
Well, I hope that we can have you back when the project's completed and published.
Oh, wow, that'd be fabulous. Thank you so much.
Well, Alexander Nicholas, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too, Mark. Thanks so much.